Good afternoon and welcome to Beyond the Headlines on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Ragini Singh Pawar. Beyond the Headlines is a weekly current affairs show that aims to make public policy discussions more accessible to you. We take you beyond the headlines of our daily news, bringing you access to current leaders through in-depth interviews. You can join us in the conversation by tweeting at beyond_headline. That's BYOND_headlines. India is playing an increasingly significant role on the global stage, especially in the Indo-Pacific region. Now the world's most populous country, India is in the midst of its largest general elections, with a staggering 969 million eligible voters, making it the biggest election the world has ever seen. While experiencing rapid economic growth and projected to become the world's third largest economy by 2030, India is also facing concerns about the curtailment of democratic freedoms and minority rights, along with the rise of Hindu nationalism. In this week's episode, we delve into the complexities of India's current political environment, from the reshaping of its domestic politics to its strategic importance on the global stage. In the first part of the episode, I speak with Professor Sumit Ganguly to explore the last decade of India's domestic political landscape under the rule of the Bharatiya Janata Party and Prime Minister Narendra Modi. We also examine the significance of Modi's larger-than-life persona, as well as concerns about democratic backsliding. The second part of the episode is focused on India's foreign policy and diplomacy. Professor T.V. Paul shares insights on India's more assertive and globally engaged approach to international relations and examines its evolving relationships with key partners. Our first guest today is Professor Sumit Ganguly. Professor Ganguly is a distinguished professor of political science and holds the Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University, Bloomington. He has previously taught at James Madison College, Michigan State University, Hunter College, the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and the University of Texas at Austin. Professor Ganguly is a specialist on the international and comparative politics of South Asia. His most recent book is The Sino-Indian Rivalry, Implications for Global Order, written with Manjeet S. Pardesi and William R. Thompson. In 2024, the University of Michigan Press will publish his co-edited book, The Troubling State of India's Democracy. Professor Ganguly is the current editor-in-chief of the International Studies Review, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. So good morning, Professor Ganguly. Thank you so much for joining me on Beyond the Headlines today.
Good to join you.
To start off our conversation, how would you describe the shifts and developments in India's domestic political landscape since the BJP took power?
Well, there have been a number of different shifts in three distinct areas. The first is that Modi, in his first term, focused heavily on welfareism and on the transformation of the infrastructure of the country, a massive emphasis on building ports, airports, new fancy trains, including bullet trains, which are super fast trains, also building highways. And simultaneously, there was an emphasis on, building toilets across India under the Swachh Bharat program and the provision of gas cylinders to women below the poverty line and the like. So that was one set of issues. Second, a much more assertive foreign policy, with Modi becoming the most itinerant prime minister since Jawaharlal Nehru. And thirdly, especially in the second term from 2019 onwards, an emphasis on sectarian issues focused on promoting the interests of the majority population, Hindus, and a certain hostility towards minorities, particularly India's largest minority, Muslims.
Building on this, when we talk about support for the BJP, do you think it is more due to the BJP's successes in governance including the infrastructure projects that you just mentioned? Or is it more a factor of the larger-than-life persona of Prime Minister Modi?
I think it's a combination again of three things. One, Modi's extraordinary ability as a communicator, his deft use of the common idiom, his charismatic personality. Whether one likes it or not, he is a charismatic leader. That's number one. Second, I think it does have to do with the dramatic improvements in infrastructure. Last year, I was in Bangalore Airport. It's superior to most airports one sees in Europe. Now, of course, it has the advantage of newness, and thereby it's quite gleaming. Let's see if they can sustain this over time, because maintenance is a real problem in India. There's really a lack of a culture of maintenance, but that may change yet. The infrastructural developments appeal enormously to India's growing middle class. So that's a second factor. A third factor, which you did not mention, is this whole emphasis on rebuilding Hindu pride and restoring India's lost glory, which was lost both to in Modi's vision and the BJP's vision to Muslim invasions and occupation of India, and then subsequently 200 years of British colonialism.
Now, we have seen the BJP having a very strong hold at the national level, especially in the last two elections, but regional elections sometimes present a different story. So, how do these regional dynamics shape the broader national political scene?
Oh, that's exactly right. That in particular parts of India, say in Karnataka, where they lost an important by-election, or say in my home state of West Bengal, where they are going at it hammer and tongs to try and make inroads, but are not having a huge amount of success. They have tried to undermine the Aam Aadmi Party in the National Capital Region of New Delhi by putting Arvind Kejriwal, a serving chief minister, in jail on grounds that he misappropriated funds or received bribes when trying to change the liquor license policy in New Delhi. I don't know anything about the veracity of these charges, but that in many ways has crippled the Aam Aadmi Party. So, in particular parts of India, I think they're going to run up against opposition, regional opposition parties. I should also mention Kerala.
Right. And now coming to the upcoming elections, what are the key issues, according to you, that are dominating the discourse leading up to them?
Well, it depends on who you're talking to. If you look at polls, people are concerned about inflation. People are concerned about the cost of living. People are concerned about law and order and the like. But Modi has really focused on three things. One, this Hindutva agenda. Second, he has, unlike in most elections, he's highlighted foreign policy issues. Not only trumpeting his achievements, some of which are a bit questionable, but that happens in all elections. Modi is not unusual in that regard, including dredging up the issue of an island that was handed back to Sri Lanka years ago. And he's making that a campaign issue about how Congress governments were weak and ceded a portion of India's territory to Sri Lanka in an attempt, I think, to curry favor in the state of Tamil Nadu, which has close to 50 million voters. where they'd like to make inroads. I don't think it's going to work. But anyway, bringing up foreign policy. Third, he has emphasized all the shortcomings of the principal opposition party, Congress.
So, Professor Ganguly, you mentioned Prime Minister Modi increasingly using foreign policy in his campaigning. So, do you think that this has any impact on voters' opinions, or are voters more concerned about domestic and bread and butter issues?
Yeah, I think voters care much more about bread and butter issues than about some spit of land in the Pok Straits that was given to Sri Lanka. I think it's a red herring, frankly, that he's trying to raise. And I doubt that somehow voters in Tamil Nadu are going to be swayed by this issue.
And Professor Ganguly, now you brought up the rise of Hindutva and the rise of Hindu nationalism. So, what implications does this have for the country's democratic principles as well as the treatment of minority communities? And do you see this playing a bigger role in Indian politics going forward?
Frankly, I find this worrisome because India is a inherently plural society, linguistically, from a religious standpoint, culturally, and trying to make this a homogeneous land, I think is a recipe for disaster. I think you're going to get pushback from a variety of quarters. And you're just going to stoke sectarian tensions, which are completely unnecessary and could undermine India's rise, which has been quite dramatic in the last 2 decades.
Expanding on this for a little bit, how do you reconcile the fact that Prime Minister Modi has high approval ratings and widespread support with concerns about increasing polarization that you just mentioned and the curtailment of democratic freedoms during his time in power?
There's a fascinating tension, isn't there? I mean, on the one hand, Modi's popularity seems to be soaring. And yet, there are sectarian tensions. There are things, there are policies that he pursued which were deeply flawed. For example, the disaster of demonetization a few years ago, which disproportionately fell on the backs of the poor who could not rapidly go and change notes at banks, particularly because they don't have the leisure to do so. They couldn't take time away from work, which puts some food on their tables, and go change these notes. And so it was a disastrous policy. During the second wave of the pandemic, Modi, in a panicked fashion, shut down the entire country, again, leaving millions, hundreds of millions of migrant workers stranded across the country, many of whom died in attempts to return home, quite apart from the loss of livelihood. Curiously enough, there's amnesia about this. Third, Modi backtracked on perfectly reasonable reforms on the farm sector because the farmers were an organized entity and protested vigorously and blocked roads to New Delhi and the like. And he backed away. In part, he failed because he had not engaged in adequate consultation with the farming constituency. With the opposition, and that's why the whole thing collapsed. Yet, other than perhaps in the Punjab and maybe Haryana, it really hasn't dented his image. In many ways, he reminds me of Ronald Reagan, who they used to call the Teflon Man. So there is a contradiction, and somehow or other, Modi manages to effectively paper over these significant public policy failures.
So you brought up the issue of protests, and I was wondering, especially given the most recent farmers' protests, as well as protests against the Citizenship Amendment Act, But do you think that these organized movements have any sort of impact on Modi's policies, or is Modi just backtracking to save face to an extent?
Oh, I think he backtracked to save face. And on CA, on the Citizenship Amendment Act, he hasn't backed down, other than some judicial proceedings that are underway, which could affect the implementation of the CAA. He and the Home Minister, Amit Shah, have been relentless in pursuing this. And I don't see them, resiling from this.
Now, switching gears a little bit, the opposition alliance titled India of various political parties against the BJP became quite fractured as the election has approached. So, how has this diffused opposition impacted the BJP strategy? Has it had any impact on their chances of success? And in turn, do you see there being any viable opponent to PM Modi? If not now, then maybe in the coming years?
It's a two-part question, and let me address it that way. There's an, I think it was an American patriot called Patrick Henry who coined the phrase that, gentlemen, we should either hang together or we will hang separately. And perhaps that adage applies with considerable force to this opposition conclave called India. It's incredible that they don't see the challenge that they're faced with, and instead interested in internal bickering about seat arrangements, about seat sharing, and the like, and the lack of a coherent platform. So Modi and Amit Shah and other stalwarts in the BJP must be absolutely gleeful to watch this disarray amidst the opposition. And Rahul Gandhi's periodic sniping without presenting an alternative, viable, robust platform, suggesting a range of different policies, other than saying we are pro-poor and we will protect minorities. I mean, these don't constitute a viable electoral platform. This is a form of sloganeering at best. To summarize, Modi and the BJP must be gleeful while watching this disarray amidst the opposition. Second, to your point about alternative leadership, yes, only if Modi does not continue to dominate Indian politics like this colossus. And, he seems to be in reasonably good health. So I suspect that he's going to serve out his third term. And in India, as you know, there are no term limits. And he may well be grooming other people like Yogi Adityanath, the chief minister of Uttar Pradesh, who has a more virulent vision of Hindutva as his potential successor.
Now, on a different note, in his second term, Modi spoke a lot about security issues, particularly with respect to Pakistan and even with the issue of the special status of Kashmir. So, do you think that this move away from more domestic concerns to foreign policy and security issues was a conscious and strategic move on Modi's part?
The Kashmir issue is basically what political scientists call an intermestic issue, that it is domestic and international, because it plays well with a certain constituency where Modi suggests that, look, we've basically normalized the relationship between India and Kashmir by stripping it of its special status. And we have integrated the state. This plays well with a certain constituency at home. And it basically, whether I like it or not personally, it was actually a very deft move where Pakistan is concerned, because it basically undermined and reduced Pakistan's legal claim to Kashmir. It was an extraordinarily skillful diplomatic move. I have to give him credit for that. You could disagree about the morality or ethics of it. That's a different matter. But from a purely strategic, pragmatic standpoint, it was an incredibly skillful move.
Speaking of constituencies, do you think that Modi has a particular core constituency? And in your opinion, has that evolved in any way during his time in power, especially in light of the infrastructure and development project that you mentioned earlier?
Of course, he has a core constituency. The core constituency, I think, had to do with people who felt that as the majority community, they were losing ground, that minorities were becoming too uppity and obstreperous, and that he would sort of arrange a course correction. But beyond that, there were other people who voted for him in the 2014 election because there was a perception, a dual perception. One, that the country was in disarray, that Congress really couldn't provide effective governance. And there was a perception that there was widespread, in fact, stratospheric corruption in Congress. One of them was, of course, the sale of the electronic spectrum for cell phones. And the shenanigans that went on were just ridiculous. And people felt that, we're disgusted with this kind of corruption. And at the same time, the disarray within Congress, the inability to provide effective governance. And here was someone who was charismatic, who claimed he had done extraordinary things in Gujarat, touted the Gujarat miracle, whether or not it was a miracle, we can debate. And the evidence is somewhat mixed. But that doesn't matter on the political stump, because politicians don't stand up and discuss descriptive statistics in a stump speech. You highlight your achievements and you set aside your shortcomings. That's typical. And Modi did it very deftly. And so that appealed to another constituency, who were not necessarily Hindu zealots, but felt they wanted effective governance, an end to corruption, and strong leadership.
And now to round up our conversation, looking to the general elections, do you have any predictions per se? And it is looking increasingly likely that the BJP will stay in power. So what might India anticipate from a third term for PM Modi?
This is a fascinating question. To begin with, I agree with you that there's a high likelihood that Modi and the BJP will come back, if not with an overwhelming majority, but certainly a comfortable majority. The disarray that we talked about in the opposition, the inability of Congress to provide a viable alternative platform, the inability of the opposition to coalesce around a key leader, all of these things have redounded to Modi's advantage and to that of the BJP. So the likelihood of the BJP not securing a majority is exceedingly slender at the moment. What is Modi going to do in a third term? Number one, he will continue this emphasis on growth at all costs, and to some degree, the environment be damned, despite some talk about concern about the environment. That emphasis, I don't think, is going to go away, number one. Second, he will continue with an assertive foreign policy. And third, which is perhaps the most fraught issue, is whether or not he might try and use a majority in parliament to tinker with some of the key foundations of the Indian Constitution. And that, to me, is the most worrisome concern.
This is a very somber note to end our conversation. Thank you, Professor Ganguly, for joining me today on Beyond the Headlines. This has been a very interesting conversation. So thank you once again.
I am delighted.
Once again, that was Professor Sumit Ganguly, who joined us for a discussion on India's domestic politics. Thank you for tuning in to Beyond the Headlines. Remember, you can join us in the conversation by tweeting at us on Twitter at beyond_headline, checking out our website, www.beyondtheheadlines.net, or by following us on Instagram at Beyond the Headlines. This week, our host radio station is launching their spring fundraising drive. For 36 years, CIUT has been the sound of Toronto community radio. Beyond the Headlines is incredibly lucky for the opportunity to air on CIUT every Monday, but we need your support to continue providing you with policy-oriented content. Donate online today at www.ciut.fm and help us reach the goal of 100,000. Our next guest today is Professor T.V. Paul. Professor Paul is a distinguished James McGill Professor in the Department of Political Science at McGill University, Montreal, and a Fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. He has served as the President of International Studies Association from 2016 to 2017 and is the founding director of the Global Research Network on Peaceful Change. Professor Paul is the author or editor of 24 books, the co-editor of 4 special journal issues, and the author of over 85 scholarly articles and book chapters in the fields of international relations, international security, and South Asia. He has authored books such as Restraining Great Powers, Soft Balancing from Empires to the Global Era, The Warrior State, Pakistan in the Contemporary World, Globalization and the National Security State, The Tradition of Non-Use of Nuclear Weapons, India in the World Order, Searching for Major Power Status, Power versus Prudence, Why Nations Forgo Nuclear Weapons, and Asymmetric Conflicts, War Initiation by Weaker Powers. Professor Paul is the lead editor of the Oxford Handbook of Peaceful Change in International Relations and currently serves as the editor of the Georgetown University Press book series, South Asia and World Affairs. Professor Paul's latest book, The Unfinished Quest: India's Search for Major Power Status from Nehru to Modi, has just been released by Oxford University Press. Hello, Professor Paul. Thank you so much for joining me today on Beyond the Headlines. We're very grateful to have you here.
It's my honor and privilege to join you, Ragini, and your radio station in Toronto.
So to just start out our conversation, it seems that in recent years, India's foreign policy has been undergoing a significant reorientation. So what has changed since the BJP came into power, and what aspects of the foreign policy have been carried over from previous governments?
I would contend that the foreign policy orientations have many continuities and some changes. The continuities are probably more than acknowledged, because if you look at policies like alignment or friendship with the United States that was started before under Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, or economic policies, economic statecraft, strategic autonomy, multi-alignment, India's policy of look east, that is increasing its ties with Southeast Asia and East Asian countries, started under Narasimha Rao. They renamed that activist. And so these policies have been rechristened, but they are not really substantially new. What is new is, of course, building up the more relationship with Middle Eastern countries, which was also happening under previous regimes, and quite a bit of a relationship with other global South countries in Africa, again, building upon previous governments' policies. But I think where the difference is, the previous governments were open to a dialogue with Pakistan to some extent. This government has taken a very tough line on Kashmir, and basically, there's no discussion going on. The second one is the worsening relationship with China on the border. Partly because of Chinese incursions into contested territories. And India's somewhat strong responses to that. This government also has built more infrastructure on the border with China, and their plans to deploy more troops on many of these contested areas. So overall, it is a policy improvisation. There is certainly a more momentum Bilateral trade deals rather than multilateral trade arrangements. That's again a continuation of previous government's policies. I see more continuities than ruptures or differences in policies.
Thank you for that very comprehensive overview. So would you characterize India's approach to foreign affairs to be driven more by ideological values or by pragmatic, real politic considerations? And why do you think that's the case?
That's a very interesting question. Actually, very much a realpolitik. And the difference from previous governments is that this government is not shy of saying it is driven by realpolitik or national interests. It defined it a very classical, realist, or simple narrative in some sense. Previous governments would add a lot of ideological notions such as peace and good relations, etc. So that's still there, but it's less prominent. All countries are driven by some amount of realpolitik, even when they are projecting it as an ideological struggle. Indian policy in the past under Nehru had a lot more ideology because of the support that India wanted to give to newly emerging states for decolonization, etc., and new international economic order. And non-alignment itself had both normative and national interest-driven ideas behind it. So this government is actually more realpolitik oriented in terms of increasing India's economic and strategic autonomy to some extent. But internally, it is driven by ideology, as we know, the Hindutva ideology. But the external manifestation is limited, partly because there aren't too many takers to the ideology other than the Indian diaspora or the Hindu diaspora or elements of it. I wouldn't claim all the Indian diaspora is for Hindutva. So this is an interesting divergence, but this government is able to use foreign policy achievements for its domestic objectives, including electoral campaignings as going on now.
So just touching on, you mentioned Hindutva right now, and I was wondering, do you think that the increasing Hindu nationalism has had an impact on India's relations with its key partners over the years?
So what is interesting is the key partners, especially in the West, have been generally ignoring, at least outwardly, this dimension of India's internal change. Partly because India is in a what you call a geopolitical sweet spot, currently because rise of China has provided India a key opportunity to offer what you call a swing state position, which is it's not aligned, but it is potentially a partner. And it has strong conflict with China. And it is the pivotal state in the Indian Ocean region. So as the Indian Ocean is now very tied to the Pacific, the US and others are calling Asia Pacific as Indo-Pacific, which was a major victory for India. Geopolitically, geostrategically, India has become important. It's fast emerging as the third largest economy of the world. And then countries are leaving China, or corporations are leaving China, and many have moved to India and Vietnam, Mexico, etc. The advantage of this position has given India some latitude in terms of its own foreign policy and domestic policy. So the Hindutva movement and some of the democratic backsliding are really hurting India in the soft power domain, which is evident in majority of Western media writings now, even I'm looking at it, become negative, although there are economic writings showing the successful economy aggregate sense as the largest growth rate happening is in India today. So if you say whether policies of countries have changed toward India because of the Hindutva movement, I don't think so. But it could if there is further fear of repression or minority rights being taken away or dramatic amendment to the constitution or things like that. So in the domain of public opinion, world public opinion, Prime Minister Modi still remains quite popular. partly due to the diaspora and the social media attention he gets. And some achievements, one has to say that under him, India has made some progress. So infrastructure in particular. But this backsliding is potentially damaging to India's legitimation as a democratic rising power, as a great power. It will have many consequences if it is not restrained by the ruling government, because it's not in their own interest to project India as a religiously intolerant state. India's greatest strength is its diversity, its multiculturalism, religion, language.
So you mentioned the government's recent achievements in foreign policy, and obviously we can't not talk about the G20 summit last year, which was a significant milestone for India on the global stage. So what foreign policy priorities and objectives did India signal through this summit and its presidency?
Yeah, that is an interesting question, because G20 is an annual meeting and it moves from one capital to the other. Before it was in Indonesia. Now next year it will be in Brazil. So it's a very regular diplomatic meeting. What Prime Minister Modi did was to turn that into a national celebration as a major achievement. India had a lot of conferences like that before. I recall non-aligned meetings, regular routine meetings, G77, you know, all those meetings, Commonwealth, a lot of meetings would happen in Delhi, nobody would pay attention, and people go away. It's a very diplomatic-oriented meeting. So what's the difference? Prime Minister Modi, the previous whole year, it was advertised. Many Indian cities had events. And if you visited India at that time, all the cities had the posters showing Prime Minister's picture with the G20 and then the BJP's lotus on it. This was a major propaganda coup, which none of the predecessors ever had the interest or the capacity to do. And that is a big difference. So people thought that this was a major achievement. Yes, it was. The achievement was actual diplomatic event, which I think attracted almost all world leaders except Putin and Xi. Xi's absence had a bit of a snubbing. And they managed to create a consensus document, a 34-page document, which addressed some issues, regular issues like climate change, global governance, food security, digital infrastructure, not to use nuclear weapons in conflict, etc. So that part was almost common as previous things, some minor modifications. But the two things that probably stood out was, one was the inclusion of the African Union as a 21st member, which I think India played some significant role in its inclusion, although it didn't receive any opposition, as far as I know, from other major players. So that was one. The second was a side deal on India, Middle East, Europe economic corridor, creating a separate corridor in terms of trade. Now, that is probably a long-term project, as the conflict in the Middle East with Israel is certainly going to delay this project. So overall, it gave a good ambience, good feeling to Indians, as well as it was covered quite well internationally, since many world leaders were there. But then Prime Minister Trudeau's interactions did not help all the festivities. But the trouble with G20, if they don't implement these things pass, these resolutions pass, and then they become yet another meeting. So the question is, will the successors implement some of these ideas? And will India play a further significant role in implementing them or encouraging others to implement them? So there lies the diplomatic challenge for India. Passing resolution is one thing. Getting it done is another thing. And at the global level, it's much harder to implement anything, because countries have to agree on many things and then circumstances change. So next year's meeting will be the test if this year's ideas are going to be continuing to the G20 agenda for years to come.
So you spoke about China a little bit earlier, and I wanted to expand on that. So India has a contentious relationship with China, but at the same time, China is a significant trade partner for India. So how does India navigate its security concerns, especially with its membership in the Quad, while balancing its economic relationship with China?
Right, this is an interesting relationship. Unlike Pakistan, India has managed to develop an economic relationship with China, partly for self-interest reasons. India's border conflict has been going on, as you know, since the late 50s and flare up in 62, and there was a long period of absence of any relationship. But since Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi's visit, there was quite a bit of momentum in trade relationships. And previous to governments of previous leaders in China and Indian leaders agreed to freeze the border conflict for the time being, continue negotiations, but increase trade. And the trade has really increased major fold, partly because India imports a lot of manufactured goods and machine tools and components for pharmaceuticals, etc. Those are core Indian export items too. So Indian economy is doing well partly because of these cheap products coming from China, and people often ignore that part. There are no alternatives for those many large number of products in the world, and China's advantage lies in cost, and then it can supply these products. India is not alone. United States, all the European countries all have trading links with China. China is managing its relations with all these countries despite its conflictual relationship on geopolitical terms. So in a way, it is one of the reasons why there is some level of interdependence, economic interdependence, reason why the flare-ups on the border don't escalate beyond a point. It's not military deterrence alone. It is also a calculation on both sides. We don't want to escalate and cut off this relationship. So it's a managed rivalry up to a point, although it has deteriorated. The two leaders, they used to meet frequently or almost every year. That's gone now. They don't seem to have much interaction at these common global meetings as well. So there is a personal level, it's not working well for India and China. But at the same time, economic relationship is good for India and for China too. China, of course, doesn't gain that much in comparison with its trade with other partners. But there are certain core sectors where China benefits having this trade with India. So yeah, it's a paradox. But I think it is also a strategy by India not to abandon China trade and cut off completely whatever influence it can make in China's foreign policy vis-à-vis India and the region.
And just moving further north now, Russia has been a long key strategic ally for India. So what is India's reaction been towards Russia's invasion of Ukraine? And how has this impacted India's relationship with the West?
Yeah, so India has a very deep relationship with Russia. And in fact, in my book, I discuss quite a bit the reasons for it. Six or seven times, it was the Soviet Union that vetoed resolutions in the UN Security Council against India. It was always there as a protector of India in 1971 war in particular. It offered both military supplies and strategic cover. Not only that, Indian leaders always felt very welcome in Moscow. This was not the case with the West, especially the United States. So they were treated as leaders of global South countries, developing countries, whereas the West had a very oppositional, confrontational view towards India for its non-alignment policy. So there is a deep-rooted societal level relationship. Doesn't mean that Russians know a lot about India, but clearly, Indians have a memory of this as a deep relationship. The war, the aggression that you Putin unleashed really affected India, I think, but it's not clear how much India could have done. Perhaps a bit more openly coming out and saying that aggression is not the way to go, or take some more initiatives for some kind of settlement of that, although it's very hard to see how it can be resolved, given the goals are quite elusive in terms of Putin as well as and the resistance that the Ukrainians have put up. So India has been buying Russian oil at a very cheap price. And indeed, now it is second largest importer of Russian crude. But there are two things that people forget often. One is the crude is converted as proper oil. And quite a bit of that is exported to Europe. European Union countries through Rotterdam in the Netherlands. And this has really helped Europe, but maybe that's why the Europeans don't seem to make much noise out of it. Only the US seems to be more concerned. The second aspect is India and United States have a common interest to prevent an alliance between China and Russia. If an alliance forms, that will be a formidable alliance, and then that will be against the interest of India as well as the United States and the West. So I think the United States has a strategic calculation that perhaps it's good that India keeps a good relationship with Russia. So deep polarization in the international system is what this relationship may be avoiding. But outwardly, it looks rather mercantilistic in the sense that we are just getting as much out of this conflict when indeed the poor Ukrainians are suffering. But the question is whether such a sanctions on Russia will force them to give up. It's in fact, the Russian economy seems to be doing quite well, partly because of trade with China, but with India too. So it's a very tricky situation that the conflict offers, and it may drag on some more years, as there is no real effort on the part of anyone to engage. And here, I think G20 could play a bit more role, as these countries are members, except Ukraine, of course, and how to bring together some new ideas onto the table.
That's really interesting. Thank you. So now, last year, allegations surfaced regarding India's alleged involvement in assassinations in the US as well as in Canada. So how have these allegations influenced India's diplomatic relations with these countries, as well as India's reputation globally?
Yeah, it is an interesting question, because I think the relations with Canada is probably the worst in this scenario. Relations with the US and other Anglo-Saxon countries like Australia, New Zealand, and United Kingdom haven't been suffering much on account of it. Part of it is the Sikh diaspora in Canada is the most active and powerful. They have a big role in the electoral politics of the country. That's not the case in the other cases. The US, they don't play any key role. Of course, Indian diaspora is active, but they are not necessarily one religious group. So Canadian politics is heavily influenced by this diaspora activism. And Canadian politicians have also been, let's say, making use of them to a point for their goals. And here the challenge is two narratives, two perspectives drive these two countries. India is an old civilization, but a new state, a relatively new state. It believes in the Westphalian idea of sovereignty, territorial integrity, and autonomy. In other words, it doesn't want anyone to interfere in its national unity. Canada, on the other hand, is driven by a liberal ideology. Liberalism has a lot of strands. One of them is self-determination of groups seeking independence, especially the groups claim or have a claim because of certain discriminations in the society they live. So if a majority of a group wants to secede, that should be possible. So the Indian reaction is, of course, in the past has been violent. We know the Sikh temple was attacked, in Golden Temple. And that had a lot more impact within Canada among the diaspora than any other country. So Prime Minister Modi's approach has been to strongly tell Canadians, you stop this, especially there have been some recent incidents, stop this activism. And but Canada has been somewhat reluctant. although they have taken some steps, I believe. And then, of course, the assassination, which Canadian Prime Minister raised in that public forum. The challenge for raising it at that point was that this was Modi's most glorious moment in the G20 meeting. And that was also an opportunity for Prime Minister Trudeau because he was meeting him. And that didn't go well. And then, of course, the backlash in terms of diplomatic ruptures. Now, India has become a lot more assertive on its policy with respect to extrajudicial, extraterritorial activism. And I don't know exactly what happened here. I don't have the evidence. So, but obviously, if there is an end to this, would mean all the parties agreeing to restrain. First of all, Canada has to have some restraint on what groups can do and within the limits of its democratic freedoms. India not getting so sensitive about anybody saying anything about freedom or separation, because the more they do that, the issue gets more publicity. Right now, the Khalistan movement has a lot more publicity in the West than it probably deserves in many sense. So there are challenges to that. Where is this relationship going requires a lot of efforts to bring it back to even a normal sense. So they have to give up some of these ideological preconceptions up to a point. A certain level of pragmatism has to come in. And I think for that, it may require some more deep engagement. And people who are not necessarily in government, at track two level, one can talk about non-governmental people engaging, trading relationship could improve. But I think for the time being, until the elections are over in Canada and India, nothing is likely to happen. And Canada is also hoping that the other countries would support it. That support has been somewhat limited because of the geopolitical relationship they have with India.
And now just to round off our conversation, looking ahead, it seems quite likely that Prime Minister Modi will secure victory in the upcoming elections. So what major foreign policy opportunities and challenges do you foresee for India in the coming years?
I think a lot will depend on other conflicts emerging, China and the US, for instance. If there is a big naval competition in the Indo-Pacific, and if there are possibilities of Taiwan conflict escalating, India may have to take some positions. It's not going to be like Ukraine. You can't just remove from this conflict. US would expect India to support its activities. Of course, direct intervention may not be feasible, but India can do a lot of secondary support, especially for naval activities. But any war in the Indo-Pacific will have unpredictable consequences. India is better off without great power conflicts, great power polarization. India's whatever strategic autonomy is feasible today because the great powers are not fighting directly. So India has to make a bit more effort to avoid or prevent the escalation of great power conflicts. Of course, that may require great powers themselves taking initiatives. But I think at least outwardly, India has to show that it has a big stake in global order, global peace, and Indo-Pacific peace. It likes a good relationship with everyone. That is one goal. But so that may be a big challenge. The second area will be economic relationship, where India actually might do better than any other areas, because the policies the Prime Minister has initiated or strengthened, including infrastructure building and improvement in trade. Quite a few areas where Indian economy is attracting foreign investment as well as foreign participation. Now, this, of course, there's a lot of room for improvement that will substantially increase India's position in the global economic system. But a weakness of India is its low human development. In the book, I talk about this is actually a big drag on India, where I don't see the current government and previous governments putting the money where education matters, skill development matters of that considerable number of youth who are now getting some kind of education, but not the proper education to be effective entrepreneurs and builders of the economy. So the demographic dividend, that's this segment of the population that could be a major asset, is not really utilized yet. So if at all the Prime Minister and the BJP have something to achieve, that would be the next focus. They're giving money to the poor, limited handouts and keeping them happy, but that segment of the poor, the rich-poor gap is much wider in India than in any other country in the world today. I mean, any major country. And it's widening. Billionaires are growing. So can you do something about that? It's not just by giving small monies and small food or kerosene to the poor. Their condition won't improve substantially. Of course, temporarily, it will allow them to eat food. The point is their children have to go to school, good schools, and get educated and become part of this country's economic and political, social milieu. There I see a weakness, because the main aim seemed to be aggregate growth and not a developmental state-oriented approach. Unlike, say, East Asian countries or Southeast Asian countries that became economically powerful, but they also put 8 to 9% of their GDP to education. India is still 3%. It was 2% all these years. And healthcare. Only infrastructure has increased spending in India. So, but still rural infrastructure is a challenge. So it is a matter of how India wants to emerge a highly unequal country with a low human development for a large segment. And then, of course, the political marginalization of the large minority community, the Muslims. These are all not going to give a face of a successful, nice country. It has a lot of good qualities, the society, its religion, etc. Everything has to be projected. The good values have to come out. At the moment, we are in a very different mode of thinking. Nationalism is good, but what kind of nationalism? And we don't know where it is heading. So a lot of these are imponderables, but successes are there. I have to say that. Indians are feeling more confident, and they also need a bit more education on the value of democracy, inclusiveness, and all the other good things we call as for a successful, high-quality life country.
This seems like a good point to end our conversation. So thank you so much, Professor Paul, for joining me today. This has been a very interesting and insightful conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Once again, that was Professor T.V. Paul, who joined us for a discussion on India's foreign policy. Thank you for tuning in to Beyond the Headlines. You have been listening to Beyond the Headlines on CIUT 89.5 FM. That wraps up our show for this week. We were joined today by Professor Sumit Ganguly and Professor T.V. Paul. Many thanks to them for coming onto the show to shed light on India's domestic and foreign policy issues. Today's show was produced by myself, Ragni Singh Pawar. If you liked today's episode, please like and review us wherever you're listening. The views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, CIUT, or the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy. If you missed any part of the show, be sure to check out podcasts of all our episodes on our website at www.beyondtheheadlines.net, as well as on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you're a fan of our show or want to stay up to date with policy issues in Canada, follow us on Twitter at beyond_headlines. You can also check us out on Facebook and Instagram. Be sure to tune in next week as we continue to take public policy discussions out of the hallways and onto the airwaves.